DePasquale from the Racing Commission would come up, and remember, just before we start, and test or presenters too, we have to be out of here by 9:25 today. Rules is going to be here at 9:30, so we can work together and get through this. That'll make it easier for everybody. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
and
committee members.
Introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Certainly. Tom DePasquale. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission, and with me today is Deputy Director Joe Skirto. Members, thank you for inviting us to testify. I'll give you a very brief outline of the commission and its responsibilities, and then Mr. Skirto will describe the financial aspects of the commission's operations. Our authority derives from Minnesota Chapter 240. It's a bill that was passed in the early 1980s when racing started in Minnesota. The commission is comprised of nine commissioners. We're operating with eight right now due to the recent death of Ralph Strangis, our chairman. We have around 12 full-time employees, and that staff balloons during the racing season when we bring people in who are involved in providing veterinary services, employees in the state testing barn, and of course the racing officials themselves, the stewards and judges. The MRC's roles are to ensure the integrity of horse racing and card playing at our two tracks, at Canterbury Park in Shakopee and at Running Aces in Columbus, just north of the Twin Cities. We oversee the distribution of funds that our inputs into the industry, which Mr. Skirto will describe, back into the industry through the administration of the Breeders' Fund and the providing of state bred awards. And we provide for the safety and welfare of the human and equine participants. So how do we do that and what do we do? Well, we license around 5,600 individuals and vendors per year. We do background checks. We have an investigative staff that does comprehensive background checks on each and every one of those licensees. Around 1,400 of those licensees are horse owners. We also conduct pre-race inspections. We do about 8,800 pre-race inspections by our commissioned vets each day. So every horse that races has been examined by a commissioned veterinarian. Those veterinarians also observe the horses in the paddock and on the track, so they're watched throughout the day and after the races are run to ensure their well-being. We also conduct financial and operational audits. Recently, we hired a staff auditor who is responsible for overseeing both our internal controls, compliance with state requirements, and also watching the flow of funds through the card rooms and the paramutual windows. We officiate horse racing, of course. The stewards at each track are the officials. They're responsible for overseeing all that happens on the backside and during the course of the race meet, and they have plenary authority to issue rulings, discipline, conduct hearings, and watch the races being run and make rulings during the course of the races. We also conduct about 2,500 drug tests each year on horses. We're required to test at least two horses out of each race, and we may test more on occasion. We send horses to the state test barn, which is at each track. We draw blood, take urine, send it to our test lab in Colorado, and we're testing for about 1,000 substances, all but 30 of which are prohibited substances in racing. There are 30 controlled therapeutic medications, and we test to make sure that those are not, there's no overages in those permissible medications. So that's the background of what we do at the commission. The industry in Minnesota itself has really enjoyed positive trends in recent years. I like to say that the Minnesota racing industry has outperformed what's been a basically flat or declining performance nationwide. The measures that we look at are fan attendance at the tracks, the size of purses, field size. The more horses that run, the more interesting the wagering menu is, the more money goes through the windows. The more money that goes through the windows, the more is used to support the racing industry in Minnesota, both breeders and owners. And then the number of Minnesota-bred foals. Each state wants to make sure that it has enough foals to supply its racing program at its tracks. We did an economic impact study of racing and breeding in Minnesota in 2016 through the University of Minnesota Mankato, and the study showed that this is a $400 million industry that provides jobs from unskilled labor on the backside to professional veterinary services, manufacturing, construction, travel, leisure, entertainment. Those are all economic segments that the racing industry is a significant contributor in the state. Racing faces some challenges in the next few years. Certainly, the entertainment and sports market in Minnesota is growing, and competing for that entertainment dollar is an important challenge for the industry. Other forms of wagering are on the horizon, perhaps with sports betting and otherwise, that pose challenges to the racing industry, but also present some opportunities. I think I'll stop there and turn it over to Mr. Skurdo, who will describe. You've got a two-page handout that describes how the funds flow into the commission and how they flow out, and then we'll wrap up and be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm Joe Skurdo, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. Good morning. Thank you for having us. We're happy to report that the Racing Commission is in a healthy fiscal state and will not be requesting any general fund appropriations in the upcoming biennium. The Racing Commission is currently fully funded by the industry it regulates through a somewhat complex, especially for a small state agency, system of appropriations from four special revenue funds and eight unique budgets that are outlined on the first page of your handout. We maintain annual budgets for each of these eight sources and their associated expenditures. In fiscal year 18, $2.7 million in funding was received by the MRC, of which over $2 million was provided by Canterbury Park and Running Aces through license fees and reimbursements as outlined by statute. A 1.25% regulatory fee on advance deposit wagering activity provided another $515,000 to the agency, and revenues derived from individual occupational licenses accounted for just under $180,000. Funding looks to remain constant for the next biennium and should be sufficient to meet our needs pending any protracted litigation, which can be a budget buster to a small agency like ours. Transitioning to the expense side of the ledger, 83% of the expenditures are rooted in staff compensation and contracted services, so keeping overtime to a minimum, engaging the workforce where most needed, and negotiating contracts to extract ultimate value are important to keeping an agency such as ours within its budget. 11% of our expenditures are with other state agencies such as Minute, the AG's office, MMB, and the Department of Administration Small Agency Resource Team. We have discussed the costs related to Minute in previous overviews, and though still a major cost line to an agency like ours, such as paying almost $600 per year for every PC we use for each computer and service each year, the service levels definitely have improved as far as what we're receiving from Minute, and we continue to work with them to find cost reduction opportunities as we move forward. If I can make one additional comment regarding the work of Administration Small Agency Resource Team, or SMART, they are an interagency group that actually saves us money the way we look at it. By eliminating our need to employ additional professional staff who would have less experience than the professionals over at SMART, we benefit from strong guidance and oversight of both our financial and HR requirements that help keep our agency compliant and properly managed. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions on the handout or anything you have for Tom and I.
Members' questions. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Good morning.
Could you just explain a little bit some differentiation of what this different classes of licensing are? Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the statute spells out that Class A and B licensees are for the ownership and management of the two licensed racetracks, and Class C licenses are occupational licenses. And we have about 17 different types of occupational licenses, everyone from employees of the tracks, owners, trainers, jockeys, drivers, vendors. And so there's a broad array of people. Almost anybody that sets foot on the racetrack with some business purpose is subject to an occupational license. So the occupational licenses, I think if you look at the sheet, make up about 25% of the incoming funds. And the license fees on the tracks, which are annual license fees, make up about three quarters. And then that's supplemented by the advanced deposit wagering licenses and advanced deposit wagering 1.25%. So that makes up the whole pie.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you for that clarification, and I would certainly understand the licensing classes as you have depicted them. As you were explaining that, it brought to mind a concern that I have about the general increase in licensing all trades and occupations in Minnesota, really impeding kind of ladders for those who have unskilled jobs or whatever, requiring a license to go to work in the morning. So are there any positions in which you mentioned in your presentation you've got unskilled persons that work there? Do they too have to have a license to just be on the facility, or do we create opportunities to let people lift themselves up out of poverty without having to have a license?
Mr. Chair and Representative, those people, to the extent they're operating in a highly regulated environment and they are involved in putting on the racing program, they're handling horses and things of that sort, they're still required to be licensed. We do full background checks, but the license fees are quite nominal. They're as low as $10 or $15 per year. And typically the trainers or owners will even pay for those license fees. So it's not burdensome in that respect.
Representative?
And I would imagine then, thank you, Mr. Chair, that they don't require continuing education to have that license.
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, they don't, although there is skill training on the backside. There's programs offered. The Groom Elite program, which Canterbury's had for some time, provides skills in handling horses and developing backside skills.
Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. I know a number of years ago, many owners did not run their best horses at Canterbury, and you're telling me now that the purses are such that are we now getting the best horses? People are running their best horses at Canterbury.
Director,
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, what drives and attracts the best horses and trainers and jockeys is the purse structure. Right now, Minnesota, or Canterbury in any event, enjoys a relationship with the Medwakaton tribe, which you're probably aware of, that supplements purses under that agreement. So the purse structure at Canterbury is roughly $14.5 million a year, over $200,000 a day, and that's very competitive. Running Aces, too, has a competitive purse structure for the size of the track and the tracks against whom they're competing. So the quality of the racing has gone up over the years. At the same time, you want to attract horses of all varying qualities because there's different types of races. So you need to run, you know, lower-level claiming races for people that own those horses, as well as higher-level stakes races. And they have a good mix of races. And they've got a couple thousand horses on the backside of Canterbury typically during the course of a season. So their average size per field is about eight, which is a little over eight, which is good by industry standards.
Okay. Representative Mason.
Is there a contract with the Midwakaton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, there is. It goes back to 2012. And it provides about $80 million over a 10 or 11-year period, 90% of which is used for purse enhancement, and about 10% of it is used for cooperative marketing between the Mystic Lake Casino and Canterbury. That agreement lapses in 2022, and there's an ongoing dialogue between the tribe and Canterbury to extend that agreement. And as you can imagine, people who are considering breeding a horse would like to see that agreement extended because they want to know when their horse is a three-year-old there's going to be good purses to run for at Canterbury.
Thank Okay, thank you. My second question
Representative Mason.
Why send the test to Colorado? That seems a long...
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, there are about eight fully accredited test labs for racing in the United States. There are none in Minnesota. These labs go through rigorous testing to establish their controls and their standards. And we have a bidding process each year for that contract. It's a competitive bid. Industrial Labs has performed extremely well over the last few years, and we continue to have a lot of confidence in their testing. Other labs are in Florida, Texas, California, Pennsylvania, Ohio. There's not an accredited test lab in Minnesota for equine testing.
Representative Mason.
Are the tests actually run on the site, or do you actually ship the results to Colorado?
Mr. Correct. Chair, Representative Mason, we ship. The state barn, test barn, has strict protocols for chain of custody, so that when the draw is done, a representative of the horse owners are there. They're sealed, they're shipped to Colorado, and then tested under lab conditions in Colorado.
Thank you.
Representative Mason. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, like Representative Hertaus, I'm kind of intrigued on this licensing issue at the track. Both him and I have had numerous licenses in our careers. My question is, could you provide the committee a list of the licensing and the regulating agency that you report to, or if it's you that grants a license, just so we have it for our records?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to do that. We can provide you a breakdown of the types of licenses that are issued and the number of licenses issued in each type. In further answer to your question or your concern, the license fees in Minnesota are on a par or less than other states, and we've taken a look at our licensing fee structure over the years. And one of the things we're doing, in fact, we plan to do in a bill that will probably appear before this committee again on this, is the vendors have been licensed for $100 for the last 30 years or so. There was a cap on license fees. And in most states, racing and gaming vendors, who really take a lot more of our time in terms of background checks, they're more fundamental to the integrity of racing and card playing. In many states, they pay thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars for their license. In Minnesota, they pay $100. So what we're trying to do with the bill this year is get legislative approval to increase the fee structure for certain racing and gaming vendors to take more regulatory oversight, more time, and that will help us keep the fees where they are for the occupational licensees who are the people I think you're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time on that.
And, Director, when you send that list of all the licenses, can you put how much each license costs for each individual, you know, individual category, so then we can know what's reasonable and not?
We can.
Any further questions? Well, thank you for coming before the committee, and thank you for getting here on time.
I'd say no trouble, but I can't.
Yeah.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And members, we now have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. And Representative Elkins, have you read the minutes? And
yes, Mr. Chair. I'll move the approval of the minutes of February 7th, 2019.
The motion's been made to approve the minutes of February 7th. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are passed. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And I understand that you had a little bit of issue with traffic also, I understand it's Minnesota. Anyway, please proceed with your testimony and say your name for the tape. And
good morning, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Robert Doty, and it is an honor to serve as the executive director for the Minnesota State Lottery.
And can you move the mic a little bit closer? Pull it up. Yeah. And speak into it.
All right. Okay. At the lottery, I have the privilege of working with an extremely talented and dedicated staff. These 150 individuals work hard every day to ensure the lottery delivers for the state of Minnesota and for all us Minnesotans. Joining me this morning is Adam Prock, our Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs. I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to provide your committee an overview and update of lottery operations. In 1988, Minnesota voters approved a constitutional amendment to create the Minnesota State Lottery. And it is not lost on anyone at the lottery that Minnesotans created the lottery to raise money for programs that benefit all of us. This charge is something we take very seriously, and you can see that noted in both our mission and our vision that's noted on this slide. Since inception, lottery proceeds have exceeded $3 billion. These funds benefit Minnesotans in every corner of our state. As you can see on this slide, in fiscal 18, 92 cents of every dollar spent on lottery products was returned to Minnesotans. As you can see also, the vast majority of that, roughly 62%, went toward prizes. Now, in the middle section there, if you add those up, that's about 13.5%. And that went to commissions for our retail partners, our vendors, and operations. We work hard to maximize efficiencies and keep our operating costs low. While a Minnesota statute caps the lottery's administrative costs at 9%, as you can see in that section there, I'm really proud to say that in fiscal 18, our administrative expense was about 4.8%, or 4.9%, I believe. So well below the state cap. The remaining piece of that is the 25 cents that then goes to all state programs. And so on this slide, we kind of break down what that where that 25 cents goes. And as you can see, the vast majority of that goes to the state's general fund. Okay. Now, within that also, we've spent about $2.2 million have also gone to combat problem gambling. And that's part of that as well. The other biggest piece of that goes to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Funds. Now, the Minnesota Lottery offers two types of products. We sell scratch games and lotto games. So scratch games, these account for approximately 70% of our lottery sales. Last year, the Minnesota Lottery sold 48 different versions of these games, offering customers a wide variety of themes from which to choose from. I'm pleased to share that in fiscal 2018, we set a new all-time high of about $411 million in scratch game sales. Our other product, as I mentioned, is lotto games. These are games where players win by matching a combination of their numbers with numbers selected via a random drawing. Examples of lotto games include Powerball, Go for Five, and Mega Millions. Fiscal 18 also saw strong lotto game sales, driven in part by several sizable Powerball and Mega Millions jackpot runs. And I'm sure we all maybe heard something about that at one point last year. At year's end, sales of lotto games exceeded $185 million. I'm also honored to report that thanks to the support of our players in fiscal 18, our total sales reached $600 million, and that was also an all-time record for the lottery. And of course, record sales means that the lottery delivered on our mission to support our beneficiaries. There were many contributing factors to these excellent numbers, and as you can see by this slide, we contributed back to the state $145 million last year. And so some of the contributing factors that led to this are three things. One, a dedicated and forward-thinking staff, a creative mix of scratch games that included successful partnerships with high-profile brands like the Minnesota Vikings, Bold North, and social media superstar Grumpy Cat. And finally, an award-winning marketing campaign featuring the tagline, "I'm in." It is also gratifying to see the stewardship of the LCCMR and the Minnesota Legislature has resulted in the value of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund has surpassing $1 billion. The trust fund is a primary beneficiary of lottery proceeds that has been put to work in every single county in Minnesota. Many LCCMR-supported programs just absolutely would not exist today without the funding generated by the Minnesota State Lottery. Our retailers. Our retail partners are represented by the many little stars on the map, as you see, and they're, as you can see, they're located all across our great state. The lottery is a significant contributor to many local economies in Minnesota. The lottery works closely with these 3,000 brick-and-mortar retailers who sell our products. In fiscal 18, lottery retailers received almost $36 million in commissions for selling lottery products. In fact, two of our top three retailers last year were located in the city of Moorhead, which serving both Minnesotans and our friends in North Dakota. To more appropriately compensate our retail partners, in July of 2018, we put in place a promotional rate increase to 6% on scratch ticket sales and 1.5% on cashing commissions. This is an important step to strengthen the relationship between the Minnesota Lottery and our retail partners. As a result of the rate increase, retailers have received an additional $1.7 million in commissions over the past 6 months, which is a win for both the retailers and those various local economies. We have begun a rulemaking process to make these changes permanent. We make sure our pursuits and our priorities are in line with those of the governor and you, our legislative partners. We are proud of the lottery's accomplishments. However, we are also working to proactively address some challenges the lottery will face over the next few years. And the two big categories of these, one is our workforce changes, and the other is marketplace changes. So first, regarding workforce changes. Like many state agencies, the lottery has a number of legacy employees. The responsibility and knowledge held by employees who will soon become retirement eligible is critical. Our focus is to properly address team needs in the future. Doing the right thing will help ensure the lottery is able to continue driving results. The state workforce has also become more diverse. To keep up with this change, we are working to ensure we are a welcoming place and inclusive of all Minnesotans. We are also expanding our outreach to find talent that reflects the diversity of our state. With regard to the marketplace, the Minnesota Lottery primarily operates as a business for the benefit of the state. To remain effective, it is important we remain viable in an ever-changing marketplace. We must connect with adult millennials and more casual players. To support this, we design products and craft messages that appeal to new audiences. We must also have the tools that our younger customers expect. This includes properly addressing the increased popularity of digital payments. While the lottery remains primarily a cash-based operator, to remain competitive as our players shift to other payment tools such as Apple Pay, Venmo, or even digital currencies like Bitcoin, we must also leverage these tools. And when I talk about these, I specifically am referring to non-credit tools, just to be clear. Let me take a moment to highlight some strategies that we've used to drive success over the past couple years. And there's five of them I'd just like to highlight real quickly. First of all, understanding our customers. By leveraging market research, monitoring sales, learning from our business partners, and listening to our players, we have grown. Secondly, expanding our overall player base. Our goal is to sell a few tickets to a lot of players rather than selling a lot of tickets to only a few. In 2018, we expanded our player base, reaching more players in the 25 to 38 year age demographic and a more diverse population. Designing lottery games that appeal to our players. One example worth highlighting is the lottery's partnership with a local Latino artist to design our Day of the Dead scratch ticket, which is a Hispanic-themed ticket. Our work with the artist allowed the lottery to reach out and to be directly involved with this community through related event sponsorship. Next, working closely with our retail partners. They are essential to the lottery's ongoing success. And finally, supporting our products via innovative advertising, exciting and relevant promotions, and fun incentives. Results. As you can see, our strategies have worked, as we have seen an increase in annual sales to almost $600 million, you can see by this graph, from $480 million in fiscal 2009, and that's a 25% increase over that 10-year period. Secondly, you can see by the other graph here, an increase in retailer commissions that now sees our average retailer's annual commissions exceed $12,000, which is about a 71% increase from that same 10-year period. Our most important measure remains our ability to provide resources to the state to benefit Minnesotans. These important funds are used to improve our lakes and rivers, save endangered species, and support many other activities to make our state's quality of life better. We are pleased to report that our fiscal 18 contribution to the state was the highest in the lottery's 30-year history, and that was that $145 million that I reported earlier. Finally, in conclusion, we are gratified with our success. The lottery team remains committed to doing better. You can be assured that we will continue to support our players and our partners, work hard to position the lottery for a strong future, remain leaders in our industry, stay focused on raising funds that can be leveraged to have a positive impact on the lives of Minnesotans. Mr. Chair, if it is okay with you, we would like to take just a moment to show about a one-minute video. The lottery produced this to highlight one of the many great projects that benefit from the support provided by the LCCMR by the lottery.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Why don't you stop it and we'll look. And he'll get the sound on.
BP oil spill was the biggest oil spill that we've had to deal with in the continental United States. There were still Minnesota migrant wildlife species in the Gulf, and the ones that we felt were the most vulnerable were the common loon and the American white pelican. We received a total of $651,000 to study how this event might be affecting those two species. Loons that had been tested the year before that had no contamination had the oil and the dispersant in their systems. We're just now right on the verge of getting a settlement for the first 3 years of conservation work that could total as much as $6 to $7 million. Citizen involvement is going to be the biggest way where we can spread the word, not only for now, but for future generations. You might have a beautiful lake, but if it hasn't got the loons, that's not a special lake.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you and thank the members of the committee and welcome any questions that you may have.
Well, great. I have a couple of questions to start out with. One is I just want to clarify, when you talk about legacy employees, you're talking about long-term employees that are about to retire, not employees that work for the legacy, just so there's no confusion on that for the public out there.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. You're correct.
And do you have any data on the money that goes to the Gamblers Anonymous or those type of groups to help prevent gambling on the effectiveness of those programs, both in prevention and in recovery?
Mr. Chair, we would have to get some additional information on that. We know that what I can tell you is that in the presentation I mentioned that we've given $2.2 million went to problem gambling. Now that was split in different ways, and if you needed additional details on that breakdown, we could absolutely provide that to you.
Thank you, sir. And Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got two or three questions if you would indulge me. Gentlemen, on your booklet here on page 32 and 33, it has a statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position. It also has notes in parentheses, different categories. Is there anywhere in this book or somewhere else I can find the notes to these statements, particularly?
Mr. Doty. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, it's online, and okay. It's easy to pull up the entire our entire financial package, includes the notes.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And gentlemen, under operating expenses, salaries and benefits, can you talk a little bit about the size of the staff and how many people are employed by the lottery?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we have approximately 150 employees, and that kind of ebbs and flows a bit because we have some part-time and summer employees as well, but it's roughly about 150 employees.
Okay. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My last question, in your presentation, you talked about the commissioning of artwork, and I understand maybe spreading the wealth is fine, but what concerned me more is hearing that you were targeting for lottery sales certain populations in Minnesota. I don't think that's necessarily wise. I think that the targeted population should be the population as a whole and not be looking at minority populations to increase spending on lottery sales.
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I appreciate that comment a lot. And one of the things that we've attempted to do over the last few years is to not target any single population, but to expand our overall player pool. We are interested in reaching out to all communities, including those minority communities, but we are absolutely not targeting any specific community. So I appreciate that, though.
Representative Hertas. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was looking at this, and I probably information's in here, but trying to page through it is hard. So you got 62 cents on every dollar that goes back to the state, or goes into prizes, and then you showed the portion that goes to the general fund. Does that include the prizes that are taxed? And you're taking the tax dollars off that? The reason I ask is because even though I've never won the lottery, I do know someone that won $100,000 once, and they took home $62,000 of it, and the rest went back to the state and federal government for taxes. So is that included in this?
That's not included.
Director Doty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, Representative, that amount is not included in the prize number. That
okay.
would be separate.
So excuse me, Mr. Chair, yes. So actually, you could be looking at taking another third off of that 62 cents and putting it back into general fund or federal governments as well?
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, that tax amount is coming back into the state. So I mean, it depends on, it's like almost like a shell game to one sense of what piece are you talking about where you want it to come from. But it is going back to the state.
Mr. Chair, I like the analogy of a shell game. I tend to agree with that. But
better than three card Monty.
So, and then I also was reading, and it seems like let's say someone wins the big prize, and I know it's probably irrelevant because very few people in the scope of it across the United States win, but do you know how many people actually take the cash payout? Because if apparently, from what I've been understanding, if they take so much a year, they can get the whole prize, whereas if they take the cash, they get a big chunk knocked off for taxes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have the exact percentages of people who take the cash payout. What I will tell you is that from my experience and what I've seen since I've been at the lottery, the vast majority of people do take the cash payout. And I think that it's the whole idea of I won this big amount of money, I want the money now, and so they opt for that. But you are your assumptions are correct.
Okay.
Representative Green.
Well, one more question then. On the unclaimed prizes, and these are probably not technical questions. I don't need you to get me the information. It's just I'm curious.
Sure.
On the unclaimed prizes, is that like big prizes, or is that mostly the people that win, you know, a couple bucks and just don't turn the ticket in?
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Actually, it's a little bit of both. The majority of it, I would say, would be smaller prizes, but we definitely have some larger prize winners that just have not come forward, and then for whatever reason may not. I mean, just kind of a side note, the big Mega Millions winner last year that we all heard about in South Carolina, and you know how many gazillions that was. That person has still not come forward. And in fact, the clock is ticking on that. Now, that's South Carolina, not Minnesota. But it does go to show that, you know, sometimes people aren't paying attention. They may have purchased a ticket and forgot about it or whatever. But it's a little bit of both.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Green. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doty, mm-hmm. A couple of questions just to clarify. It's good that you're going into the digital age with the payment process. Mm-hmm. However, I just want to question, are you looking at going into the digital age for the gaming process?
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you know, we take our direction from the legislature. And at this point, that is not part of our plan at this point.
Mr. Doty, I'm happy to hear that right now, because I think the retailers, this does a lot for our retail population, and it definitely brings people into the stores. My second question is, I really like the fact that you said it only takes, you're looking at, you're going after your new demographic as not multiple tickets, but one. I'd like to see more ads on it only takes one. I think that's, I've had an experience with people that buy hundreds, 200 tickets, and they know they don't win the next day. So I think that's a great concept, and I hope you do take off with that.
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you very much. I appreciate that. I mean, that's our concept of expanding our player pool. I mean, it really is about not trying to sell a whole lot of tickets to a small group of people and spreading that around. So that is truly one of the things we're trying hard to do.
Director Doty, I saw 60 Minutes a couple weeks ago. There was a report on somebody that was, a couple states have a roll-down type of lottery game, and there was a retired couple that was buying, had figured out that by doing, at certain times, buying a whole lot of tickets that they could win a lot of money, and they've actually created a small corporation to do this of friends and relatives, and they won, according to that, won millions and millions of dollars over the years. We don't have anything like that in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, no. In fact, it's funny you mention that, because I was just in a meeting yesterday where we were discussing how to make sure that we prevent that same type of thing occurring in Minnesota. And some of what we've got, our tickets have some features that make that more challenging. And we are constantly looking out for that kind of thing.
Thank you. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, when these prizes get big, $2 is pretty cheap gratification just to imagine the possibilities. I think we've all done that. Gentlemen, when the lottery first started, and I do know a lottery winner that did win, and it was before the cash option was available, but I never asked him this, but is it true that if you take the annuity that if you should die before all of those should be paid out, that the annuity ends, or is it remain with the estate?
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is true.
It remains with the estate?
Yes.
Okay. And the last question is, it's come to my attention in traveling around the country when you land at an airport and you see the Powerball is pretty big and maybe it's time to buy a ticket. I notice on some states the back of the ticket has only a six-month redemption period and the ticket is void, versus Minnesota it's 1 year. Why is that? I mean, we're all not subject to the same rules?
Director Doty.
Mr. Chair, Representative. I don't have a specific answer why that's different. I mean, each of the 47 lotteries are independent and are set up. They're structured differently. They're set up differently, and some cases definitely have different rules that they are governed by. So that's a great question. I don't know if I have a real good cogent answer for you on that.
Okay, thank you,
Representative Hertas. Any further questions? Oh, Director Doty, Representative Hertas reminded me of a good friend of mine I used to deer hunt with. Once one high in the lottery, we always for fun bought him as we went deer hunting and sit there and look at the numbers because there wasn't a lot else to do at night. And he said, you know, if I win this lottery, I'm going to run out in the woods screaming. And he said, just wait about 10 minutes and follow my footsteps and you can have the ticket out of my dead body because I'm going to die of a heart attack. He said, promise me you'll take care of my wife. Thank you for your presentation, and have a nice day.
Thank you.
Next up, we got the gambling board. To the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Barrett. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Gambling Control Board. Appreciate everyone being here. Knowing time is limited, I do have a quick PowerPoint, not as flashy as the lottery, pretty much plain black and white, but hopefully it'll guide you through, give you an idea of what we do, how we do it, and the industry that we're regulating, be it the charitable gaming industry. So with that said, our board, the mission is twofold, quite simple: maintain the integrity of all operations, be it the games that are produced for sale in Minnesota, as well as the operators, the vendors that are involved in the conduct of gambling, along with the charities. And then the second point, obviously, getting money to the bottom line to help fund the missions of the charities, be it the Veterans Post, the Youth Hockey, the Fire Relief Associations. We do that with a seven-member citizens board. Five are appointed by the governor, one is appointed by the attorney general, and one is appointed by the commissioner of public safety. I have a great staff of all 32 people. We're split division-wise, licensing. If anybody's going to be touching the product or involved in the conduct, they go through our licensing product process, including background checks. Our compliance and audits unit, that's the biggest makeup, but that's the staff that are auditing the charities, doing the site inspections. We have a small investigative unit where we get things of, you know, theft or non-compliance. We'll involve those folks. And then administrative staff, all of three, counting myself, relatively small. How do we regulate? Like I mentioned, licensing at the front door with all the manufacturers, the charities, the link bingo providers. Anybody that's involved in the conduct of charitable gaming, for the most part, goes through our review and licensing. We take the people that are involved in charitable gaming educate, license, or excuse me, train. And if we have a sudden departure, be it a death or something that might happen with the gambling manager, we'll actually step in and do some hands-on, one-on-one mentoring. Approving games before any game hits the street, we do the testing, working with the manufacturers, working with the testing lab. On average, 525 games come through the board for approval every month. That's roughly a little over 6,300. Tremendous volume. And obviously conducting the regulatory audits, site inspections, that's really the bread and butter of our regulatory oversight. And if we don't get their attention through the training, education, audits, we do have the authority to issue fines, suspensions, and revocations, but that's as a last resort. Industry, 2,800 sites out there in Minnesota, primarily bar operations, VFW, Legion Post, and the like. 1,144 licensed charities with a full gambling license taking up sites, so roughly one organization every two sites. Each one of those organizations is required to have a licensed gambling manager, meaning a member of that organization. We put the focus on training and education, but they are licensed. They're required to file the monthly reports and the like. 3,400 exempt excluded permits. These are the what we call relatively small activity, the church raffles that occur maybe once a year, but the value of those 3,400 permits last year, $46 million in sales. Again, tremendous volume. 8,800 paid employees. These are primarily employees working on behalf of the charity. 11 manufacturers, 2 Link Bingo providers, 9 distributors, and then of those 9 distributors, they have 98 salespersons conducting sales around the state. So quite a wide range of people involved in the industry. What is lawful gambling? Pull tabs. If any of you have a chance to participate or see that activity in action, pull tabs are the bread and butter of the charitable gaming industry, roughly 93% of all sales. But we also offer a smaller form of a pull tab called a tip board. Paddle wheels, not the river boat, but the Wheel of Fortune wheel that's very popular with meat raffles around the state. Certainly bingo and then raffles. Other gambling, you heard from our counterparts, the lottery. We also, tribal casinos are out there. We work closely with public safety as relates to illegal gambling. Certainly understand some of that activity happens. And you also heard from our folks at the Racing Commission. While we don't oversee any of those other entities, we do work together when it comes to common issues involving gambling. But it's one of those things, by virtue of our title, Gambling Control Board, we do get calls as at this casino, or I got this lottery ticket. So we're quick to refer to our other regulators in the industry. The numbers, $2 billion in gross sales. This is just 1 year, last fiscal year. Tremendous volume. It surprises a lot of folks when you look at the volume of all those pull tab sites around the state. But it set a record in terms of sales. $1.6 billion went back to the players in the form of prize payouts. That's approximately an 85% prize payout. $83 million was made available to the bottom line for charitable purposes, be it ice time or fire trucks or veterans posts. $75 million went in taxes. That was also a record, and it's an issue that I'll talk briefly about as we get into it. But, and then our regulatory budget, $3.4 million. While we're the biggest in the country when it comes to sales and activity, one of the smallest when it comes to a regulatory oversight, and that's a credit to you all and the laws and the rules that are in place that guide the industry that we regulate. Where does the money go? Similar to a visual you saw with the lottery, but again, the vast majority of that $1 bill goes back to the player, roughly almost 84-85%. Expenses, but I draw your attention to the last sliver as relates to this committee, but that little line, that represents what our agency collects in the way of license fees, regulatory fees, a little over 0.1% of gross sales. So relatively small, but important nonetheless. Since 1985, this just gives a flavor of sales that have taken place. 1985 was the first year that the state took on the control, regulatory control of charitable gaming. Obviously, bingo has been going on since World War II days, but when the state got involved, and you see the trend, what was happening, how it immediately climbed. The dip you see, roughly around the 2007, that equates to when the smoking ban took effect. We saw a big impact at the bar locations and obviously with charitable gaming. And now you see certainly the uptick, as I mentioned, that we've got 9 years of increased sales, the last 4 years setting records. This is just a visual graphic, again, highlighting the fact that pull tabs by far, both paper and electronic, make up the significant portion of gross sales. But, you know, next biggest bingo at $90 million, it's still $90 million worth of activity and worthy of obviously keeping an eye on it as we do. Expenses, this is not the board expenses, but this is a visual of all the charities that are licensed, and it's primarily to bring home the point that between the compensation of the people that are selling the product, the gambling product, the cost going to the vendors that provide it, and then rent, we call it rent, but it's basically compensation to the bar owners for the ability to have the charities in those locations to sell a product, and last fiscal year was just under $31 million. Taxes, hot topic, and I know there's a few bills in play in terms of addressing the tax issue, but nobody wants to pay taxes, we understand that. The board's neutral, but in terms of the impact on the industry, certainly able to provide some regulatory perspective, but this is a chart that tries to graphically show the nature of the progressive tax. The more a charity makes in the way of sales, the higher the tax rate. So as the year wears on, roughly 84 of the 1,100 organizations were in the top tax bracket. And on the low end, 481 were paying a little less than 10% of their net receipts on taxes. But it's a focus nonetheless that I think you'll be hearing more about as the session progresses. A lot of questions we've got. What about those electronic pull tabs? In the early stage, when they were first allowed, a lot of media attention that our projections weren't up to it. In fact, somebody referred to it as foo-foo dust. But after there's been some acceptance, we certainly have seen a rise in that medium, that format, involved electronic pull tab sales. Some of the issues. These are coming from the charities, as I mentioned briefly, the tax rate and structure. Again, I'm aware of a few bills before you looking to modify that. Sports wagering. I know none of the other two talked about it, but it's been a topic that's here. The only point I would offer is while we're regulatory, whether it's the Lottery, the Racing Commission, or the Gambling Control Board, we're aware of what's been going on in some of the other states. To the extent there's some interest or questions that come before you all, we're prepared to give some insight regulatory-wise, but we take no position or advocate anything as it relates to the sports wagering. But it's one that would affect, if allowed, it would have some impact depending upon what happens on the charitable gaming industry that we do regulate. Issues from our perspective. Right now, it's $2 billion, it's all cash. Certainly, a regulatory perspective, we want to be mindful of that exposure of the cash at the bar locations. And so we're trying to work with the industry to minimize that risk of theft, robberies, and the like. But also, as the demographics are changing, more of a cashless type situation. We're not advocating switching to a debit or credit, but it's an issue that's starting to rise up, I think, within the industry. You heard the counterparts of the lottery, similar concerns in that respect. Aging veterans, and I point this out simply because veterans posts make up roughly 27% of all licensed sites, but we understand the veterans are aging and it's tough to get replacements, good replacements to help with their organization. So mindful of that, we work close with the American Legion leadership, the VFW, in terms of trying to assist when we see organizations falling short on their reporting. Usually it means they need to get some fresh eyes on the activity. And frankly, the lack of volunteer. That's nothing unique to the Gambling Control Board or the charitable gaming industry. It's tough to get volunteers. In the early days, a lot of people would volunteer for the good of their charity, not so much. And that kind of ties in with the rising potential for rising expenses. Looking ahead, sports-themed tip boards. Again, we talked briefly about sports wagering. There is sports wagering currently happening in Minnesota. This is part of the 2012 bill that was allowed. It's a very small element, but nonetheless, it does offer charities an opportunity to have games out there that it's based on the outcome of a football game or a baseball game. First month of full sales, almost 700,000 in sales in that activity. But when the Vikings got out of the playoff, sales dropped. So something to talk to them about. Link Pull Tab. We see some success with Link Bingo. There's some talk from vendors, charities expressing an interest. How about a linked bingo game that goes not just at each site but across the state? Something we're, you know, regulatory-wise looking at, but it would require legislative approval. But that's just a concept right now, nothing that we're proposing. And then reduce fees. Certainly the interest of this committee, with the sales increases as they have, we are proposing, not in our, the governor's budget, but might come in the way of one of those tax bills, proposed reduction in our fees, simply because the amount we've been collecting is certainly the covers what we need in terms of same level funding. So we're expecting that to come through as well. So with that, hopefully as brief as I could be, but certainly stand for any questions. I did include a copy of our annual report. That's the blue, plain, black and white, as well as the most recent newsletter that we send out to all licensed charities. Just some informational things that give a broader picture of what it is and how we do things.
Well, thank you. And as I was looking at your chart on page 10 regarding the, and you said the smoking ban had a lot to do with that dip. It also looks like that coincides with the recession that in 2008. Does that have an effect on your full tabs? And when the economy goes down, is do people still buy, or is that one of the things they get rid of right away?
Mr. Chair, no, that's a very good observation. And, yes, it wasn't just the smoking, but that's where we saw the instant drop. I think the recession kind of took long. But as we see with the economy and other factors, some people say, well, what do you count for the increase? We have no scientific, or I don't have an economist on staff. But the good economy, lower gas prices, you know, it's all those things that might contribute to additional discretionary income that people would have, to whether they play the lottery or partake in charitable gaming.
Well, thank you. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Personally, I've always had some problem with taxing charitable gambling. And I know you said you're having some problems with volunteering. And I'll take one of my local organizations. I mean, they were asked to expand their gambling deal to another facility. But by the time they get through with the taxing, I mean, it's just not worth their time. They're volunteering to pay taxes rather than having the money to actually go to the activity for which they are actually trying to benefit. Is that a major, you know, I'm assuming that goes statewide, but if you can elaborate on that, that would be helpful.
Director Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. While we'll be up front to say we're neutral, I mean, the taxes are set by you all and the rates. But I think to understand the progressive nature, the more you make, the higher the rate. We have a company locally out in Vadnais Heights, Merrick. They provide transportation needs to the disabled. That's their mission. They by far are the number one charity. They're paying the highest rate. And yet they're looking to expand sites. So talking to their CEO and their gambling managers, you know, as you get more sites and income, the higher the rate. And they acknowledge that. They acknowledge taxes are part of the business, as they call it. For them, though, the value of that one or two pennies on the dollar versus a lower tax charity, they equate that, and they still find value to the extent that they're expanding. But your point of, geez, do we really want to get into this business to pay the taxes? Now, it's not set up, you know, they need to be mindful of their expenses and the like and what's left over. But, you know, how that dollar is split, we do monitor that. And for the benefit of you all, we rate each charity, and there's reports on our website, and I should have brought a copy maybe, but we give them star ratings. If 50% or more of their lawful purposes go to charities, including taxes, they get a five-star rating, 40%, 30%. When they hit 20%, they truly are on our radar for what it's all about. It's about getting money to their mission. And so we'll put them on a one-year notice. They need to increase that. And there's a number of factors. That's why I talk about the expenses, but also sites. If they got a site that's not doing the numbers that they'd like, that might impact it as well. So we do keep an eye on it as best we can as relates to getting the money to the bottom lines. And it's a tool. Again, it's on our website. You could go in alphabetically by the city and look at your charities to see how each one of those rates in terms of total operation, gross sales, net receipts, what got to taxes, and what got to the mission. So it's helpful. And the charities know you all look at it as well. So they're mindful of trying to run as good operation as they can. But taxes are an issue. If you're to look right now the way it's set up, and I may have been taking too much time, but taxes for charitable gaming are primarily based on the net receipts of a charity, where the lottery, selling similar products, right, a scratch ticket versus a pull tab, they have what they call a, in lieu of sales tax. So on average, for every $1 lottery ticket, the state is collecting 6.5%, I believe, is what we heard. On average, charities are paying in roughly a little less than 4 cents. Now, is that a discount for charities or the way, that's just how it works out. But again, those charities that are making a lot of money in terms of sales, they are paying a much higher rate.
Representative Mason. Further questions? Well, thank you, sir, and hopefully if we have any more questions, they can direct them towards you and towards your office.
Great. Thank you, members.
And I see somebody in the audience that wants to speak. Mr. Geller. And what can we do with you for you this morning?
Thank you, Chair and people on the State Government Finance.
Please introduce yourself for the tape.
My name is Rick Keller. I'm officially represent the Twice Successful, Minnesota Statute 120B15, and print disability, found on the ID Act of 2004, as well as the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008. Specific questions, obviously it only goes through the chair if participants want to yield to the question. What I provided here, and I can certainly provide you one, but it's a correspondence from Minute, dated 4/17/2018, Guidelines for Accessibility and Usability of Information Technology Standards. I got page 1 and page 8 showing here. But I have, one of the questions I had asked is, ask these participants today, do they manually test the criteria for accuracy in accessing accessibility by simulating the user's experience? I have reviewed these documents over at the Senate. They're not posted now online. They're not accessible. These are state agencies. One other question I was going to ask to the chair, if the participants want to answer it, was to state Lotto machines, are they ADA accessible for the blind and visually impaired? It's my understanding they don't have Braille or read out loud.
Well, thank you, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you is only good as what we apply. And thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'll leave this with your staff.
Okay, thank you.
And I did send an electronic message to Ms. Mattson, Mr. Green, and that people were in the Senate, Kiff Meyer and Tori Westrom on this. Again, if the outcome of IDEA, the core statement for all students, is future education, employment for independent living. Independent living also includes recreational. And I assure you that their websites using a web aim tool that the librarian has suggested, they are not accessible, including the Get Help gambling.com, which is, I believe, by Department of Human Services, is not fully accessible. So this is systemic. The legislature is suggesting to use the tool as a screening tool for web accessibility. State agencies need to be on board on this as we move ahead, providing more fairness and sameness for everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to speak again.
Oh, thank you. And I would ask the agencies that came before us to take note of that, to make sure that the stuff that they put online is accessible for all.
Through the chair, of course, I think for them to respond to those questions, since we don't know that, because it's word of mouth from me, for them to codify it and give it to the members, because I'm not here for myself and I want to be isolated. I think the leadership needs to know this as we move ahead for opportunities for everybody. So respectfully, I ask that you ask them to submit a correspondence to you. If they want to copy me, that's up to them, but I'm here to just make you aware of the situation as it relates to recreational activities, including gaming. Thank you again.
Well, thank you, Mr. Geller. And with that, Mr. Members, I said to the testifiers, please take note of the presenters. And with that, members, our meeting being done and our business being done, this meeting is adjourned.